Let's first begin with a word of prayer. Gracious God, we are so thankful for this church, for the opportunity to meet with special friends who have you in our hearts and on our minds to honor with all we do. We ask that you send your Holy Spirit to our words and to our ears as we listen, to make it all be to your honor and glory. In your Son's name, amen. First, I want to make a little bit of an introduction to some friends. Over here dispersed is the Genesis class, where I usually am. On Sunday mornings, it's a very auspicious group of a Sunday school class. We meet at 9:30 in the parlor, the South Parlor. You're all welcome. We have members. Oh, there's Doug on this side. Of course, Doug is always on the other side of everybody, but we have a lot of fun together, and we have good treats, and we also have excellent Bible study. So please, we join. We aren't meeting now through the summer, but once the seminars get started up again in September, you have the choice of either this or our Genesis class. I know it's a tough choice. I was a member at this church for a number of years since we were married in 1984 until about 2000. And I was very influenced by not only the membership, but also the education, particularly for the adults. That was strong in the church where I grew up, and it was even better here at Westminster with all of your resources and the proximity to the seminary. So I am very indebted to your tutoring and your friendships and your support. We need to start back further if we're going to talk about women's ordination. And of course, I want to include not just ordination to the word and sacrament, but also to the offices of deacon and elder. But before we get to those power offices, we need to start with women again. And so much, I think, of what we heard in the past 2 weeks is supportive of that. But I want to draw attention to the idea that the first seminar brought up, is the idea of the women's sphere. Let's see if I can. Oh, that's the pointer. And I know you can't read this line, but this is indicative of the early 1800s, maybe even later. But this woman's sphere, spheres of place or influence or in a worldview, was not a modern idea. The Greeks and the Romans had their philosophies that included this idea of sphere, certain things going on in certain areas, and certain people were from or responsible to a certain sphere. But adding women to it is particularly of this era. And what it did, Tocqueville, I think, even remarked about this in his comments about what was different and fresh in the America when he was here visiting. But the woman's sphere was an idea of domestic ideology. You have heard of the women's putting women on a pulpit or a pedestal. Isn't that interesting that I confused pulpit with pedestal? I wonder what that says. But it was that at the same time that there was this industrialization building up, and you can understand with the steel mills here in Pittsburgh, and I remember growing up with the blast furnaces, and if you drove by the mills, if you were driving along one of the rivers, you might see those plumes of dirt and smoke, and at night the sky glowed over there as they poured the slag onto a heap from the steel being made. So the Industrial Revolution was nasty and dirty and manly, you know. So that kind of went into the men's sphere, and then opposite that, in a kind of a cleansing sense, was the home. Women would have an a place that was pure and moral and soft and kind, so that when men came home, they were refreshed or reminded of better things in life. And it was a contrast, but also that something that went together that helped make sense. And Lisa, in her book, or in her lecture, also talked about myths that help us make sense of a world that is chaotic. So in any change in a culture, there is chaos. That's what we feel as though we live in. So these spheres were developed as a sense of comforting us in the chaos. Although for the women of the for the women's part, it wasn't all comfort. It was very limiting. As you knew, they were, if you weren't particularly interested in decorating or cooking or raising children, you were left out. So what I take from this, and something like this comic showing a woman bound with a fence and little images of gossip. You know how women got their reputation? Well, it wasn't a new reputation. Moses' sister was reputed to be a gossip. But fashion, that was the women's sphere. There was nothing very intellectual about it all. Women had a hard time getting an intellectual milieu. They weren't welcome as much into colleges. So there was all this energy, I think, that couldn't find its outlet in any of the public spheres, because public spheres were closed to women. Women couldn't speak in public, they couldn't speak in church, they couldn't even pray in church. When women had their women's meetings or their mission societies, the minister had to come to open with prayer, because goodness knows what they were going to pray about. Well, that was one of the comments of one of the ministers who, what were they going to pray about? The women were innately weaker and innately weak spiritually and intellectually. So that became this pent up, which I think, of energy that spawned the phenomenon of the volunteerisms, the women's volunteer organizations that began to be developed in the early 1800s. And then they became a lot more visible nationally. And this is something that Tocqueville noticed. So I want to start with women's role in leadership by talking about those women's societies, the women mission societies, ladies' mission societies that followed the idea of the volunteerism that were in the community. They brought them into the churches, and they had these independent groups of women missionary societies. And they were sort of tolerated by the men of the congregation. They didn't bother with them. They sort of gave them patronizing compliments once in a while for some of the money they raised, the work they did. But they were so energetic in doing things like some of the things that are done today, knitting, sewing, making clothes, anything that some of the missions outreach in the National Board of Missions, the domestics, and the Foreign Board of Missions at the Presbyterian denominations were doing, they supported. And they were allowed to be independent. They just ignored them. The ministers, the men who were elders of the session, they just weren't interested in what the women were doing. So benign neglect was a real opportunity. And I want to emphasize how capable these women were at getting things done. If you want to understand the background of some of these sales meetings, lunch meetings that you've ever been to, such as Tupperware, longer burger baskets. Oh, the crystal people. I could go on, and you know those names of those groups that women sort of went into business by hosting parties and raising money and then selling these things. That whole ethic of organization by connections among other women or with other women in a very organized way with a lot of good communication, which really were kind of a pyramid scheme, a good pyramid scheme. It wasn't taking money from one level and filtering it upwards. I think that's what generated the truly managerial skills that were found in the independent ladies, mission societies, in individual churches. But now that also evolved into something else. Do you remember any of you seeing on the PBS channels in the 70s a program that I thought was called Change, but it isn't. It's called Connections. It was hosted by a man. He wore the same outfit in the whole every episode. I mean, a woman would not have hosted that way, but, you know, men. But then probably they just filmed all of the episodes at one time. But I don't remember his name. But by odd chances of inventions happening in one area or in the early sciences seemed to just find itself in a totally different area. And that it jumped and enabled something else in another form of discipline of science to then blast off itself in another invention. I wish I could give you an example, but that I didn't grasp that in my research. So nobody else remembers that. Dave does. Thank you, Dave. Good member of Genesis Bible study class. That's the kind of excellence in study and world understanding that is brought at Genesis class. But anyway, what I mean to say is that there came upon them another missionary, a missionary who was working for the Presbyterian Board, and his name was Sheldon Jackson. And he was an independent son of a gun. He always wanted to be a Presbyterian missionary, and he was also ordained. He went to the right school, he went to the right seminary, he went to Princeton, but he was rejected for international missions. Well, that time they called it foreign mission, because they didn't think he was physically strong enough. Now, they didn't elaborate on what his injuries or infirmaries had been, but he was accepted into domestic missionary experience. So he threw himself into that, and he went to Oklahoma, where he got malaria. But there was a number in Oklahoma. Yeah, you learn all kinds of stuff when you delve into history. It's not all homogeneous that what you learn about the subject you think you're going to learn about. But this was in the mid, maybe even toward the later part of the 1800s, that he was doing missionary work in the Midwest when churches, people were moving Midwest to start farms and move west for new land. And he then went to mission to them. He started churches, gathered groups of people who knew one another, sort of neighbors within a very large geographic areas, which considered themselves farmer neighbors. And then he got them together and then started a church. I think it was probably a non-denominational church, but then he connected them to the Presbyterian Church. So he started a good many churches. In fact, when he was in Minnesota, which was where he went, I believe, after Oklahoma, his territory, or his parish, he said, amounted to about 13,000 square miles. So this man moved. And he sort of was like a 19th century, who started the Methodist Church? Wesley, who had this great reputation of moving around on horseback, which so did the Presbyterian minister. It's earlier, but Wesley seems to have gotten the reputation of really moving around in a large areas and establishing smaller congregations. But anyway, and then he heard of an appeal for missions to some children in Alaska. They had no schools. Now, Alaska was to be named Seward's Folly. Seward thought that was that great potential up there. But he couldn't get anybody to go there, this Sheldon Jackson. And he asked around. He was very good at recruiting staff to come take over a mission once he had made it stable. But he couldn't. He struck out with Alaska. So he went himself. And lo and behold, he met a woman on his way, or in Portland, Oregon, or was it Washington? One of those Pacific Northeast states. And she happened to have a connection with a woman in the missionaries, well, Ladies Missionary Society in the New York area. So he put two, they introduced one another, and she heard about his need for people to go to Alaska, and she had some experience in with her husband as a minister in Arizona in the Southwest, and she followed him. She went with him. There wasn't any romance, I don't think, involved, but she was just a missionary, and she thought this man was young and bright and knew what needed to be done, and she went with him. And Jackson, I saw on the internet that in Alaska, he's named one of the top 10 Alaskans. He wasn't born in Alaska, of course, he was born in New York. But because of the work he did in Alaska, he was well known, because he did really establish the education in for children in Alaska. And with his work, which he knew was going to be so big and demanding in the whole territory of Alaska, he knew he was going to need a whole lot more money. And the women raised the money for him. This one woman that had introduced him said, I've got a friend in New York City. We'll just tell her what we need. And right away, in the first year, this missionary group of women gave him enough money to establish the annual salary for the missionary for the first site. So he knew a good thing when he saw it, and he kept that connection. And those two formed a beautiful relationship for the next 100 years with the Board of Missions and the National Organization, and then what happened in the development of these local individual church mission societies. But at the same time, this is all fitting together and they're helping one another, was this great growth of printed material. Everybody was making newsletters, newspapers, tracts. Everything was printed. So because that they could do that and they could communicate, that's how the individual women way down in the independent churches were able to find out about all of this mission activity at the men ran at from the Board of Missions for the National Presbyterian Church, the General Assembly. And so it just started to build, not only because were they organized, but they were well informed, and they wanted to do this. They felt that it was something that was hands-on for them. They did all their sewing and their knitting and their mite boxes. They collected funds, at least coin. We still do, or do you still do, in Presbyterian women? The mite. And so all of these vehicles that they had were poured into this mission for the Presbyterian Church. Domestically, the home missions, they called it. Now, the idea that Sheldon Jackson had about mission for the Presbyterian Church that was unique and that was a hard sell for him to get support for at first was the idea of having education included with the mission of spreading the gospel. But Sheldon thought that these two had to go together, or else he just found that children, he had a long-term vision. And if the children could be raised up and educated within the church, then they would have a long time, forever, a membership. So with these women, he had his own ulterior motives, a little bit of selfishness, but it worked out. So with his support of the education and mission and the national boards, the director of the national board also buying in and supporting Sheldon's idea, he sold it to General Assembly. And so General Assembly made it a recommendation or an overture, however it came out, that each synod had to have a connection, a supervisor, to coordinate the women's activity that was going to all the mission work. And the women loved this. It gave them even more connections and more avenues, and it made them more successful in ability to raise money and support the mission. And they really bought into the idea of education along with it. I'm not sure if I have these notes on how much money they raised. But over the years, into the late 1800s, 1898, I think it was, women, just these ladies' societies and the individual churches, once it was collected and donated to the Board of Missions, they raised more money than the entire Presbyterian Church by a substantial amount, several thousand dollars in 1898 dollars. They ended up having a tremendous amount of power because of that. Money speaks. They also made good friends in the national organization with a few men. Betty and I meant to introduce Betty Sykes. You're on one of my slides here later, so I need to recognize you now. Here with us, no, this is much further. But Betty Sykes and I went on Thursday to a luncheon and a program that recognized the first woman who was ordained in the Lutheran Church. I don't know which Lutheran denomination, but she was the first woman ordained in the Lutheran Church. And as she spoke and told her story, now I forget why I was going to bring her up. One of those senior moments, you know. Betty, what was I going to lead up to?
Maybe you were going to talk about when 1956 was when we first ordained.
No, I have a lot to talk about before that comes. Sorry. We're still deep in the, just at the turn of the century.
Well, I was the first of a number of things, and she was also the first of, so maybe we'll connect
things. I'll probably think of it as I leave. But Betty she tells us that when she went to seminary, she went to San Francisco, and she already had her family when she felt the call. She was already married. So it was, in a way, it's a very typical path to women's becoming ministers. So she had this family as she was going to seminary. And in her class, she was the only woman in her seminary class. And she wasn't one of the first 100 women ordained, but she thought maybe she was part of the 110 first women ordained. And you were ordained where?
Denver Presbyterian.
In Denver. Her father had been a minister. Told me a few stories about him in our car ride. But anyway, women's ministers group that we belong to, that we went to on Thursday, is called the International Association of Women Ministers. And they've been around for 100 years. We'll be celebrating 100 years in 2019. So I was going to talk about Betty, but, oh, it's Betty's book that she loaned me. Or is it lend? Betty let me borrow her book that talks about the experience and about the story of women, what it took for women to be ordained. So along the way, Sheldon Jackson convinced them and coaxed them into becoming a national organization themselves. That was how they got the power too. Not only did they financially support the men-run General Assembly Mission Board of the Presbyterian Church, he convinced them that they had to have a women's national board of mission, a women's board. And through the extraordinary leadership of several women, two women in the beginning, and then another woman began in the turn of the century, the 1920s. That happened. It became an independent board of the General Assembly. Now, women were not ordained yet, even as elders. They had no voice in the church other than as a member in their church membership. Now, who remembers their communicants class material? What powers do members have in the Presbyterian Church? Just membership. When you join to be a member, what powers do you have? What can you do?
Vote.
Vote for what?
Whatever's being presented on that Sunday morning.
How many of those meetings do we have? Does the membership have? It's called a congregational meeting. How many of those do we have a year?
One.
And what's on the agenda for that?
Minister's salary.
Well, that's one of them, yes. Terms of call. Is that what you're most interested in, what we make? Well, I'll tell you in a little bit what we make. But what else?
Budget.
Okay.
Offices.
Yes, that's it too. So really, a member only has the ability to elect your officers and then also to vote on issues of property. If there was a group of people in the church who wanted to leave and go to another denomination, they could, but only if the membership agreed to withdraw. And then there's a process to do that. But women didn't really have any ability to participate in the church other than make all the food, maybe do some of the cleaning, you know, the domestic things. They couldn't pray in church. They didn't speak in church. To have an independent board that was run by women, that was only answerable to the General Assembly, which how many remember what the organizational structure is for Presbyterian churches?
Yeah.
Sue, another member of the Genesis Sunday School class. Sue.
Well, there's General Assembly, then there's the Presbyterians,
and then the Church. Right. And so, is this a hierarchy of arrangements? No, it's not. I had drummed into my head so hard by the minister at my communicants class and the written materials that we got from the Presbyterian denomination that it's not hierarchical. The structure is concentric circles of inclusiveness. So churches are members of the presbytery, which is just a wider circle of congregations. And presbytery's membership is made up of half of, half ministers and half elders in equal numbers. And that's who make up a presbytery. And then there are presbyteries that make up synods. It's another inclusive thing. They're not as active as they used to be. But there's just some way to deliver program and to organize other functions other than at a national level, excuse me, which is the General Assembly. And the General Assembly has a staff that works year-round to maintain the structures that any organization needs to do, but they do not then make the policies. The policies are made at General Assembly. But how does the assembly agenda get established? If you, let's say, let's do a little quiz. Let's say somebody in the church, a real influential group in this congregation, wants every church to be white clapboard with spirals and a minimal brick. They have the stone is out. Every Presbyterian church, it's part of this branding thing that's so prevalent now. All churches, all Presbyterian churches have to look like Westminster Church. So how would you go about introducing that change? Doug?
Overture.
Right. Tell us what an overture. Well, wait a minute. Before that, who presents an overture? Well, but who presents? How would this church be able to make an... did they make an overture to the... Okay, so somebody gets an idea. Well, but who can... You're skipping a little bit of a process. You're skipping a body. Yeah. Okay, so this person isn't... the head of this committee is not on the board of... is not an active member of session. She's an elder. He is an elder. So that would have to come from the session. They would have to present this idea to session. If session approved it and wanted to get behind it, then the session would present it to the presbytery. And then what happens?
That would be presented for consideration by the General Assembly.
The next time it meets... Right. And so then all of these overtures that come together, some of them may be similar. So they're all divided up. If you become a delegate, who can become a delegate to the General Assembly, by the way? Come on, this is easy. Yes. Equal numbers of elders and clergy from each presbytery are then delegates to the General Assembly. And then once you get there, you're assigned to a committee. Of course, everything is done in committees in Presbyterians. And then the like ones are kind of coordinated and written up together. And they'll make the committee will make a proposal of what will be presented as an overture, as a change to the constitution of our denomination. So... Oh, yes. Yes. The presbytery members, the elders, and...
Mm-hmm.
So you see why it's a phenomenon that women in the church, by the turn of the 20th century, had all of this money-raising ability and managerial ability and organizational skills to affect the change, to get themselves a agency at General Assembly, and they don't even have anything beyond a church membership. I know why I mentioned yesterday or Thursday and Betty. The woman we heard, Plotz was her name, actually she grew up in Carrick, and went to Chatham. But she said, I did not struggle to become ordained. But the men who paved the way for me, who supported me, who did things ahead in order for me to be ordained, they were the ones who took the risks. And that was what Sheldon Jackson did, and the director, and I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, of the domestic home mission The domestic missions of the board of the Presbyterian Church also did. Those two men stuck their necks out and saw what the potential was for these women, and that's how they got to have so much power. All right, now we have to jump ahead for another 20 years, a couple decades, and where nothing else happened, except a lot of change and chaos. And maybe I'm sure some of you will understand what's happening during the 20s. Remember the Roaring 20s, you know, that change in social mores, the change in theology. The fundamentalists were in every denomination, everywhere, were trying to pass their five tenets of Reformed faith that everybody had to buy. And it was like the virgin birth, and I forget. They wanted these to be the essential tenets. And if you didn't adhere to them, it was heresy. And you would then, if you were a minister, you would be out. And if you were a lay, maybe worse would happen. But so there was all this fighting. And then the Depression came, and there was just hard times for the Presbyterian Church. And so they all looked, of course, they had a study, at what might be needed to improve things. And one of the observations made to this committee and to General Assembly is, you have too many agencies. My gosh, I can't tell what responsibilities one has from the other. It's sort of like the place I work in corporate America. I mean, anytime somebody wants to get a little fiefdom, they just reorganize and have a new department. And with these names, that you can't tell what they're responsible for. But anyway, that's an aside. So that was really, that was a problem. They had overlap and they had duplication. And so over the next several years, there was a big study done. And what ended up happening was, what happened? Can you guess? They reorganized. They reorganized. What do you think happened in the reorganization? You're afraid to say it, aren't you? It's just so, huh? Well, they did away with the separate women's home agency, home domestic mission agency. Now, some women thought it was because of discrimination. It really wasn't. The same thing happened to some other mission agencies that were solely male-run. It's just that then you ended up with one center combined foreign and domestic mission, board of missions at the Presbyterian Church. And several other functions were also drawn in. I think it went down from 43 boards to something like maybe 17, 14, something like that. So it was a huge impact on a lot of programming. There goes the choir. You're excused. But I need to press on. But it's important to see the struggle for power and how you need to think about what the things that need to happen before you think you have power and before it's taken away. Because the opportunities were really missed to capitalize on this women's power before they lost it. And once they lost it, then they had to start all over again. But they could have pushed at that time from the 1900 until, you know, the teens, 1920s, for women's ordination, at least as elders, at least as deacons, but nothing happened. They didn't bring it up. But when they finally did, it came about this way. There was still some dissatisfaction. And of course, the General Assembly decided they need to have a study to identify the roots of this dissatisfaction, particularly among women. And so whom did they appoint to, or who did they appoint, I don't know, to this study for why women were dissatisfied? Who do you think would be good people to establish this study? No. Close, though. But I think behind it were some men who had helped these other women in their missionary support, suggested that the two women who were running the Women's Board of Domestic Board of Missions head the study. And they did. The extraordinary skills of not this person. Oh, this is Sheldon Jackson, sorry. Looks like every male at that time. Let me come back to that. Oh, I remember, I couldn't find her picture. But there were two women. I couldn't find a picture of the woman I was thinking of. But she and her secretary were in charge of this study. And they published a 30-page study. And that's a good question. 19. This was, it came up before the 1920 General Assembly. Yeah. And so when they presented this study to the General Assembly staff, they recommended that women needed to be ordained as elders, deacons, and ministers, word of sacrament, all of them at once. And they said, oh, well, you know, that's a little bit too much too fast. And so the general, the staff decided that the overtures were going to be three instead of one. They could ordain women as elders and deacons. Now, I'm not sure whether deacons was included. It wasn't mentioned in the book. They could ordain elders. They could give them, or they could give that or overture to the General Assembly in the 1920s. Or the second one would be that they could give women the ordination to be a minister. Or they could give them all three at once. They were either just ordination to ward and sacrament, or to elders and deacons, or the overture could be all three. So it was decided among this General Assembly committee, not the General Assembly that met that year, but before it got there, the committee that gets the overtures together decided it was just going to be the one. And it was just going to be for elders and deacons. And that's what the vote was. It was passed overwhelmingly. It was not hard to pass. So then women had their right to be ordained as elders and had a voice then in the session meetings at their own church. And then, of course, as elders, then they could be elected to serve their church, represent their church in the presbytery. Each church would have an elder representative to presbytery, and then an equal number of, or however many ministers were within the presbytery, were all members of the presbytery, even if they were retired. So if there were more ministers living in the area, then they would, by size of congregation, they would allow another delegate or elder to go to be a member of the presbytery. So things got started that way. But the reason why that passed, the one other reason for the women's dissatisfaction is that once this women's board agency was absorbed with all the rest of the ones that were run by men, then the session seemed to take it upon themselves to enforce that the money the women had raised independently for their women, their ladies' mission had to go into the church treasury. Now, that didn't happen everywhere, but it happened enough to really make the women angry. And I can imagine what pressure they put on the men who had been ordained as elders, or even the ones who had been on session, their husbands. So, I think things were pretty cold for a while, and they were asking for a solution. Well, this was it. The other thing about Jackson is that he didn't say, well, okay, you can split your women, you can split your mission contributions. You could either send it through your church, in your church's contribution, and your contribution to your church, or, you know, you could send it just directly to the General Assembly, bypassing your own church, and just send it directly to the mission fund. Sheldon Jackson didn't say that. He says, no, you double your contributions. So not only were women raising a phenomenal amount of money in the Presbyterian Church for mission, more than the rest of the church, they were not cutting back on their contributions to the churches. They were giving double. And you wonder why it took so long for women to be recognized for what dedication and what inspiration and what the depth of their spirituality. But the ordination of women to the Word and Sacrament came not until the 50s. 56, I was 1 year old, 1956. All right, you're all going to be doing the arithmetic now that I told you my age. But in 1956, and that vote wasn't, that was a, oh, wait a minute, let me make sure. I'm not sure if I wrote down the, Betty, do you know? How was the vote for that? Was it close? Did you know? Do you remember? For women's ordination? But I don't think it was difficult to pass at all. But, you know, a lot of the sentiment was more practical reasons for doing that. This was after Second World War, of course, and churches were booming. Men came home from the war, and just like this church developed. This Westminster Presbyterian Church, its establishment, was happening all over the United States. Churches were booming, and there weren't enough men going into seminary to staff them all. There were fewer men. In fact, the number of men going into seminary was declining. I think because there were really good professional opportunities elsewhere, probably to better support their families, and they had learned other skills when they were in the war. So things were dramatically changing, and there was also this practical reason to ordain women. It's because, you know, they were needed in the churches that they staffed. But what kind of calls were they getting? Not very many. Women still had a hard time getting a call and getting good calls. There was this thing going on in congregations, the larger ones, with their emphasis on Christian education that, of course, arose out of the mission efforts, to have a Christian educator on staff at the church, in addition to the minister doing it and the lay people teaching the Sunday school. The next associate they wanted was someone in charge of Christian education. So that's where the women who had these seminaries degree ended up. And the salaries of the Christian ed non-ordained position was not going to pay them very much. But they had this master's degree, but it wasn't being used to preach. And
you're saying, Anna, when I was ordained in 1971, there were about 110 women ministers, and there were about 12,000 ministers at that time. And of the 110, only 19 of us were pastors of congregations. The rest were church musicians or educators or in some mission situation.
Yes, if you didn't hear that, Betty said that of her, at her time when she was ordained, there were 110 women ministers ordained clergy. And there were 12,000 clergy in all in the denomination. So you can figure out that percentage. But only how many of the 110 were called to a position of a pastor at a church?
19 of us were. was his church that couldn't get anybody else to come. So the presbytery approved their calling me, although the terms of my call were lower than the presbytery minimums. They said I was lucky to have a church at all. So, and that was not unusual.
Presbyterians are known for paying their ministers better than, let's say, Methodists or Baptists, because I think the presbytery sets a minimum, which has it's a factor of the economy as a whole in the area. So that's how that gets established, so they pay a fair salary. But they'll make exceptions for women. Women don't need to make that much of a salary. They're, you know, their husbands are supporting them. You wanted to say something.
Yes, many Christian educators in the churches were the wives of the associate pastor or the pastor. So they then received more money from for their family because they were the wife of the pastor rather than being a seminary graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went into Christian education, you were competing against pastors' wives.
Mm-hmm. So these Christian educators, nobody liked them. The minister's wife didn't like them. She was encroaching upon her territory in the church. The ministers didn't like them because if they had a degree that was as much as on their level, they were going to challenge them. You know, they were afraid of them. Literally, they didn't say that, but they were. And they just got no respect. They were the Rodney Dangerfield of the denomination. We still do have a lot of clergy couples. One of my friends I was talking to, she works quarter time, and her husband works the three quarters. So the two of them only make up the one total salary. Let me see what our... This is the first woman who was ordained in the Presbyterian Church USA. That would be the Northern Church at that time. Margaret Towner, and she was a Christian educator. I think she may have even... I don't know if she was in a church or if she was in a teaching position at a university or a college. And then later, she eventually worked her way into a real pastorate. You know, she became a pastorate of a church, left Christian education. And then this Rachel Henderlite was the first woman ordained. That wasn't the age at which she was ordained. This is an older picture. She was from the Southern Church. So you notice the difference in the years. 64 versus 56. 8. Notice how I did that so quick in my head. And this is Betty's quote. And it's what I want to say happened from 56 to the 90s. And I'm quoting her. So Betty, I may not have gotten you correct in our conversation in the car. It was our destiny to lie down as bridges over a canyon so that other women could walk over our corpses and thus move the cause along. So these poor first 110 women, one of Betty's friends remarked to her, this is what it's like. Hello. They're probably right about the use of this room. I have five more minutes. I wanted to leave you with a few quotes about what today is like, how many of there are us. I could not get a count of the total number of women ministers there are in the Presbyterian Church. Oh, Dave knows. Another member of the Genesis Bible study class.
Are there any women?
Oh, I thought you were going to answer my question to give us... Well, it depends on what you mean by staff.
Head of staff.
Mm-hmm.
Head of the church.
Head of the church.
It's, I'm might have a couple.
Judy Slater. That was one of the
Well, she works for the Presbytery, or she did, and she has a pretty small church. The woman up here, the minister at the Bethel Presbyterian Church, she was just called a woman.
Linda Ruby.
Who?
Linda Ruby.
Linda Ruby.
In
pardon me?
In Adam.
Yes, I was just going to mention the woman who is followed that difficult period at Ben Avon. She was installed. Tell me your name. Donna. She's head of staff. They don't have an associate, but that's about as high, I think, as they get. Now, there was another woman at 6th Presbyterian. She left. I'm not sure who they called after her. She left. They may have had an associate part-time. And there's another woman there now, but that's like teeny. Oh, Brookline.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's still very small. I don't know if Louise was an interim. Okay, but she still wouldn't have had a staff. When I think of pastor head of staff, I think there are other associate ordained people on the staff, not just like custodians and secretaries.
Former Presbyterian executive, who is a female, who is the head of staff of my home church, with about 1,200 members. So, I mean, Pittsburgh, granted, may not be the best place for a woman to climb the hierarchy.
Well, not only... not only that, but our denomination is shrinking. Not just because some churches left to go to some of the more conservative denomination, but because our membership in overall is declining. So there's just not as many opportunities. One of the things I've read recently is they're talking about dual career, bivocation, they call it. Well, let me tell you. That would mean you would serve a church and you would also have a full-time job in the secular world. Full-time or half-time or what? I don't think there are part-time jobs anymore in business. I think they did that away with that. And if anybody tells you that they're part-time at a church, I don't care if you have 30 people versus 130 people. You still put in the same number of hours. People just want more of your time. And doing a worship service takes the same amount. Preparing for a worship service, whether you're doing it for 5 people or 2,500, it's the same. So it's not going to work. Anybody who tries to do it is going to be very frustrated. Not only that, I mean, I really gave up trying to do any pulpit supply. I work full-time now at a bank. And I tried to have a weekend job. I can't be 2 people. Who said it? Did the Bible say you? Yes, there. It is scriptural that you cannot have 2 masters. You cannot serve 2 masters. I really psychologically have a hard time not knowing who I am. There's just a different person that is required in your business work, and there's an entirely different persona when you're in your ministry. And I don't know really how lay people who also are kind of faced with that. But if you're called to the ministry, there's something that is part of who you are that's more than I'm a Christian, Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. About who you are and your talents and what you've been called and your responsibility. So I need to quit. So what do you, if you have other questions, I know your name.
I'm Heather.
Heather.
And I know both of you, but you have to understand that women also were active in many other arenas in our the culture. For example, it was women that started the Medical School of Philadelphia for women during that time.
That's true.
They were active in the church. They were very active in starting a medical school for women because women were not accepted into medical schools. So they provided medical education for women who were unacceptable because of their gender to get into medical school. The same may have been true in the legal profession. A friend of mine, we both went to graduate school here in Pittsburgh together, and she was one of the first women lawyers who graduated from Pitt. But she said, you know, the ladies were on the third floor. I mean, they didn't even, or the first floor, they didn't even think of having women be students when they built the building. So as a result of that, there were only the guests on the first floor. So that whatever, wherever you were in the legal graduate school, you had to go to the first floor. That's the only ladies were in the building. So it permeates everything in culture. It's not just our church,
so some of the issues for women who are serving now are, gosh, let's have some better fashions. In fact, this is from Vogue on the internet. We're talking about the fashions that this woman who started this company to make these women clergy clothes, her name is Sykes. This is in England. And it's all about now women really supporting one another because the interests and attentions and the demands of our denominations are on other things right now. So it's been a struggle of you do it for yourself and you learn about what you need to have power and stay in power, and then you kind of sit for a while as attention needs to be given to other issues. And then you have to withdraw inside yourself to support one another and just keep plugging away, which is the way I want to conclude, is meaning we have to know our history. Just like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony realized that this was going to take a long time. After the 16th Amendment failed, you know, women didn't get the right to vote and other things until the 19th Amendment. So a lot of time happened in there. And she realized it was going to take longer, and she had to pass this on to the younger women to keep the movement going. And it was through the history, knowing the stories of your history and knowing the history as a history maker would know it, that is needed. So that's my story.